sometimes that it's like the car starts to slow down and slow down, and it comes to a stop and it comes to a halt. It's just so nice just staying still, not doing anything, not thinking anything, just resting in the peacefulness. And whenever I have a very good meditation just before giving the talk, it's one of the hardest things in the world for me to get the mind going again, to start it moving, to start it thinking, to get some ideas running in the mind again, so that one can string together those ideas as a Dhamma talk, a talk on the practice of Buddhism, a talk which reflects the teachings of the Buddha. And when one talks about the teachings of the Buddha, these aren't just empty teachings just to be interested in. They're very powerful teachings. They actually transform the people who listen to them. Little by little we listen to these things, and we remember these things. And as we remember them, they tend to do something to our attitudes to life. And they act very, very deeply, not just on our words and our opinions, but deeper than that, on what motivates all of these things. It gives this very wonderful foundation to how we speak, how we act, and even how we think. And that's why the Buddha kept on calling his teaching a practice or a development. Just like a person who wishes to be a good tennis player or football player, they have to train their bodies. And training the bodies means spending a lot of time, a lot of effort, pushing and flexing in order to get their body really fit and tough and strong and energetic and skillful in order to play their game or play their sport. It's like a development of the body, which is all very well and good, but no matter how much one develops the body, in the end it's going to fall apart. And it usually falls apart quicker than we admit. I was just thinking the other day that most people are supposed to live to 70 years. And we have this idea of youth, middle age and old age. But youth is very, very long. And middle age is also very long. And old age is only very short, really. You know, if we really split those old age, middle age and youth equally, a third each, then up to 23 you're young. But 23 to 46 is middle age, and over 46 you're old. Already the last third of your life. We don't like to admit that. But whatever happens, if we train the body, we can train it so much, but in the end it's going to let us down, no matter how fit we are. But when the Buddha was talking, he wasn't really paying so much attention to the body. That's why he mentioned a little bit about healing, but that wasn't the main emphasis or point of why he was teaching, because he said no matter how much you heal the body, eventually it's going to fail you and you're going to have to leave it. But the mind or the heart, this thing inside of us, that goes on and on and on from lifetime to lifetime. At the very least, one has to live with this mind, this heart, for the rest of your life. And that can be developed, that can be trained, and there's no physical reason or physical cause why that should deteriorate once it has been trained. I know there was an old Chinese proverb which I learnt many, many years ago, that if you're going to get married, they said never marry a beautiful woman. And the reason for that was, they said that a beautiful woman, doesn't really make much sense to me now anyway, but a beautiful woman, they don't have to develop their character. They can just get by on their good looks. But an ugly woman, in order to sort of be popular, to attract the opposite sex, they have to compensate by developing a wonderful personality and character. So that's why that the Chinese used to say, if you ever want to get married, never marry a beautiful woman, because she will not, no, just generally speaking, she will not maybe have developed such a good character. But an ugly woman, she will have to have a good character. And in the end, I mean, in the second part of your life, certainly in the last third of the life, however beautiful you were, you know, there's like an equalizing factor happens, and everyone starts to look the same. And it's usually not as attractive as it was 20 years ago. So the point being that good looks don't last, but character does last. what we do inside our minds, our hearts, that really does last. And so if you really want to develop something which will last, build something which will stand the test of time, then the Chinese and the Buddha advise developing character, developing the inner part of us. And even as a Buddhist, that many times we give like a standard blessing to people. May you have long life, happiness, beauty and strength. And so many people, when they hear that, they think, because it's what you're supposed to do in Buddhism, not just take these things for granted, but think, what do these things all mean? Does this make sense? They start to think, well, if you have long life and happiness, that's okay, but long life and beauty usually don't go together, certainly not long life and strength. As you get old, you get weak. That's usually the natural cause, natural result of things. But, I mean, the Buddha never said these things idly. He always had some sort of meaning there. But when he was saying that if someone does a good act, or a kind act, or a generous act, or an act of morality, or even an act of meditating, it gives you long life, happiness, beauty and strength. What he was meaning there was like long life in the sense of the long spiritual life, the happiness, not the external happiness, but the happiness of the heart, the inner happiness, the peace, the joy. And the beauty especially, that beauty which is the beauty of a character, well developed. And one sees that in especially elderly people. When I say that elderly people don't look beautiful, like physically, externally, the things get crinkly and there's actually more smells come out of the body when you get older, but with some people, they have like a radiance to them, like a sparkle in their eyes. No matter what their physical body is doing, there's something inside of them which shines through. That's the beauty inside, the beauty of their character. And it's that really which makes, especially an old person, beautiful. What they've been doing with their life, how they've been developing their inner world. And of course the strength. Not the external strength to be able to run a marathon or to pick up stones, but the strength of heart, the strength of mind, which can endure hardship, which can push through difficulties, and which can do that which is really wonderful and useful in this world. What is wonderful and useful is usually hard work. What is easy is not usually worth very much. So that hard work, they have that strength, the strength of character. So that's what the Buddha was talking about when he wished those things. He was talking about not the physical body, which when one does get old tends to fall apart, but the inner being. And this is really what the Buddha was encouraging people to develop, much more than the body. Develop the heart or the mind. Like in Buddhism, that they have this word for the inner world, if you like, the inner being, called the citta. And that word citta, it hasn't got an equivalent in the English language. It is a sum of all that which goes on inside, all of the feelings, the perceptions, the thoughts, all of the emotions, the consciousness, the whole works which happens inside, and that's an immense area. There was somebody, I think I told this to Armadale, so I don't think you heard this, a friend of mine told me that his child, she was only 6 years old, that the teacher in the class asked all of the children to write down in their book what was the biggest thing in the world. Some of the children wrote down dinosaurs. Some of the children wrote down mountains. One of the children wrote down the planet Earth. One of the children wrote down the whole universe. And this, my friend's an old school friend, his daughter wrote down the I, E-Y-E. And the teacher asked her, what do you mean the I? Why is that the biggest? That's only, what is it, maybe 2 inches? And the daughter, this 6-year-old, replied, the eye is the biggest thing in the world because it can see dinosaurs, it can see mountains, it can see worlds, it can see the whole universe and much more. Everything can be contained in the eye. And that was, for a 6-year-old, that was a really, really smart answer. And of course the Buddha would say, yes, but the mind, well, she was really meaning the mind. The mind is the biggest thing in the world. That can contain everything and much more. Universes, and for those of you who do read a bit of science, even parallel universes, infinite parallel universes, people can conceive of in the mind. So the mind is even bigger than the universe. It can contain many universes. So this inner part of ourselves is huge. And this is really what the Buddha asked us to try and develop. But when we talk about this inner world, we usually in the West, we've got two words for it, mind and heart. And when we say developing this citta, we're developing both of these, both the mind and the heart. We say the mind because the mind is usually the seat of thinking, of ideas, of rationality. But the Buddha didn't say just to develop the rational mind, also to develop the heart, the seat of the emotions, that which is often irrational. And unless we can develop both of these things, we're not really a balanced person. We need to develop both. And so often I perceive, anyway, in the Western world, that the mind is developed reasonably well. The ability to think, to rationalize, to be logical, to work out what we think the proper thing should be. But where we lose it a lot of the time is we haven't really developed the heart enough. When we say developing the heart, there's many trainings which the Buddha taught to develop the heart. The first of those trainings was just plain generosity. Generosity sometimes is irrational. You don't need that, why should I give you that? You can do it quite well yourself, or when we're being helped. Now, I don't really need you to help me, I can do it quite well without you. If we're really rational about generosity, then we think, well, maybe if we help people too much, that they just get dependent. Maybe it's best if they just, everyone stands on their own two feet and becomes independent and self-sufficient. But sometimes, if we really want to understand these things, we have to put rationality aside for a moment. There's a story which is a very illustrative story here of when the Dalai Lama was in Tibet many years ago, and as he was touring the provinces of what was then his country, everyone used to come up, not everyone, but many villagers used to come up and offer him things. That was almost like the tradition. They give him all sorts of things, whatever they had available. Now, as he was touring this particular time, there was an American journalist who was travelling with him, doing a story for, I think, Time magazine on him. As the American journalist was going from place to place, following the retinue of the Dalai Lama, he started to get, first of all, suspicious, and then disillusioned, and then just plain angry, when he saw that the Dalai Lama, the head of Buddhism in Tibet, and the head of state of the secular government in Tibet, who was given everything he could ever want, was accepting all of these gifts, sometimes from people who were very, very poor. And one day, in one village, a very poor village, an old woman came up to the Dalai Lama, in line with many other people, and her present which she gave to the Dalai Lama was a skirt, like a Tibetan skirt. And at that, the American journalist could not hold his anger any longer. And he blasted the Dalai Lama, calling him an impostor, a hypocrite. You're supposed to be someone who's following the spiritual path, a man of religion. You should be giving out gifts to these poor people, not to receive them. What do you need with a skirt? You're a man. And he went on like this for quite a while until his anger had subsided, because if you don't feed anger back, and Dalai Lama was a person who didn't feed the anger back, which just was quiet until the American had his say, not interrupting or not trying to defend himself. When the American had finished talking, the Dalai Lama said to him in his usual peaceful manner, "You're right. I don't need a skirt, but that woman needs to give it to me." And at that, the journalist had an understanding, an insight, if you like, of what the whole process of generosity is all about. It doesn't matter so much that the Dalai Lama needed a skirt or didn't need a skirt, but what it mattered was that the lady needed to give it to someone she respected, even worshipped, highly. Understanding that, we understand a bit of the hard part of generosity. We both need to give and we need to receive. Like generosity, sometimes we look upon it only in a half-hearted way of the person giving. Because when we talk about generosity, that we think of, I know, sending checks over to Oxfam or putting little coins in the little tin box which is rattled in front of you, seeing these appeals on the television. And we sometimes we think, does that charity, does that appeal really need it? How often do we think, instead of, does that person need it? How often do we think, do I need to give? Do I need to share? Like, sharing is a much better word for generosity than giving, because giving, again, is just the word which is reflects the actions of the donor. It doesn't mention the receiver. It doesn't recognize that this is an interaction between two people. It's not just with one person. Giving is just one person. Sharing means two or more bodies, two or more people. And what we're doing when we're sharing, we're having this wonderful relationship with another person, even if it's only just for a few moments, which says that I am not self-sufficient. I cannot live without you. I need you. And the other person says, I understand that and I'm willing to help, to share what I have. Sometimes people, when we tell them that we live in a monastery, one of the first things they say is, oh, you grow your own food. And we don't grow our own food at all. Well, not actually at all, that we've got some tomatoes growing, and not very many there. But we don't have our own gardens, we don't spend time making food. And that was intended by the Buddha on purpose, for the monks not to be self-sufficient. We have a lovely piece of land down at Serpentine, there's plenty of water, it would be very easy for us to grow vegetables. And if we could grow our own vegetables, then we would also extend our wall and lock it and say, we don't need you anymore. We're quite okay staying in this little monastery by ourselves, not coming out on a Friday night to give a talk, not coming out on a Saturday. We'd be self-sufficient. When you're self-sufficient, you tend to do that. You tend to build up walls and lock gates and keep people out. I'm okay, thank you. I don't need you. The Buddha made it very clear for the monastics, both monks and nuns, that it wasn't possible for you to be self-sufficient. Just for the basic need of food, we had to depend upon the lay Buddhist community, lay people to feed us. At first, when we used to receive alms, every monk has a similar experience of receiving alms. It's very embarrassing. You're receiving the gifts from lay people. And when you're first a monk, you see all of your faults, all the terrible things you're doing, when you're not on the stand here in front of people, when you go back to your hut, all the thoughts, the worldly thoughts which you think, and you think, do I really deserve this support, this food? Especially when you're in like a third world country, in a poor part of a third world country like Thailand, and all of these poor people, they're feeding you. And you start to feel actually really guilty. You know, do I deserve this? Wouldn't it be better if I disrobed and started doing some work and I could send money out to this village and maybe just even become a volunteer and go and build a school or water tanks in this village instead of just taking the little food they've got. Rationality can work that way, and it misses something else. It misses that somehow that these people are really getting something out of feeding you. It sounds weird, doesn't it? That just sitting there, being a monk, that people are actually getting a lot of happiness and joy out of feeding you. We all actually need to give. And the Buddha, in his great wisdom, knowing the mind and the heart, understood that. And he made the monastic life completely dependent upon the lay community. And that has forged a bond which has lasted through the centuries. What it's saying is that without you, I cannot survive. I cannot even eat. Just even a few minutes before coming in here, there was some chocolate just on the table next to where I was sitting. I looked at it and I thought, that really would be nice. But I couldn't eat it. Everything which a monk eats has to be given to him. And I asked Venerable Sumangla, is that chocolate offered? Has it been given? He said, no, it hasn't. And of course, that was quite a disappointment. But fortunately, there was someone else nearby who could offer that chocolate to me so I could eat it and we could share it. I had a piece myself. I gave a piece to Venerable Sumangla and I gave a tip to the person who had offered it. That was just bribing him so that he'd offer something next time. But what it meant was that even like little things like chocolate, if I was really hungry, if all the monks were hungry, and there was a kitchen full of food at the monastery, which there usually is, we wouldn't be able to go and help ourselves. Some would have to offer it to us and give it to us. What that really means, and we keep that rule seriously, what that means, strictly, what that means is that we're saying, as Buddhist monks and nuns, we need you. Without you, we'd starve. And what does that do to you when we say things like that? Usually what happens, it means that people bring tons and tons of food. I remember once, it's really amazing, but after a while you understand it from the heart. This was years ago, the first time I went to visit England. At that time, the monks in England had just bought the house, which is now Chidhurst Monastery in Sussex. Some of you may have been there and seen it. It was an old mansion, well, not really a mansion because it was really falling down. One of these five-star mansions. You look up and you see five stars for the whole of the roof. And as, because it wasn't really settled yet, that one day that they'd run out of food. And the monks would never say anything. But there was some other people there who were staying, some visitors, who realized if the monks ran out of food, they also ran out of food. And they just phoned up and mentioned it in the telephone conversation to one woman in London. And they mentioned that about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. We did the evening service, some chanting and some meditation. And towards the end of the meditation, before 9 o'clock, we started hearing all this commotion at the front door. And found out what had happened afterwards. We found out, went in and saw it. And just, you know, you just, your heart just rose into the heaven realms. That lady, when she found out that the monks had been short of food, and the nuns and everyone else staying there, she'd rang around, she'd found some shop which was open at that time of the evening. She'd packed a couple of cars full of all sorts of food, and she'd driven, like, from London to this monastery is further than from here to our monastery in Serpentine. Because of the roads, it took her 2 or 3 hours. She'd driven in the evening, I don't know if she ate that evening, all that way in order to make sure that the community at Chidhurst had something to eat. And you should have seen the amount of food came out of those two cars. And sometimes I sort of reflect, why did she do that? I mean, just a little bit of food would have been all right. Or maybe to, you know, make some arrangement with a local fish and chip shop and say, you know, you can just go down there and I'll pay the bill. No, that they really wanted to make sure that those community had plenty of the very, very best food. And when I looked at those people's eyes, you could see just like 1,000 kilowatt globes glowing. Just the shiny, the joy and the big smile they had on their face. And that was what was really infectious. After that meditation, there was this happiness in the whole house, not because you knew you were going to get something to eat tomorrow morning, but because that something, an act of generosity, an act of sharing, an act of caring had happened. And that actually becomes one of the great joys of being a monk, of being a monastic, of being part of this wonderful sharing. Because I'm saying, I need you. And when you say that from the heart, and it's serious, people respond. There's Ajahn Sumedho, the senior monk in England, when he was first invited to go over to the West, this was before Ajahn Jacko came here, he was concerned. He was going to England and America just to have a look, first of all. And Ajahn Chah asked him, sort of, how do you feel about it? And he said, I'm very, very concerned. You know, will people feed us? It's all right in Thailand, or in Sri Lanka, and Burma. There is a tradition to feed monks. But you go off to Western country, people don't know who you are, what you're supposed to be doing. You go around with a bowl, and it's really strange. People ask, you've got the snake in there or something. Or is there a drum? Now, what is it? And you say it's my alms bowl to put food in, and they think you're crazy. But Ajahn Sumedho said that, will people feed us? And Ajahn Chah's reply to that was, don't you think there are any kind people in England or in America? And Ajahn Chah always had this great gift of just giving an answer which really went very deep inside of one. Yeah, there are kind people all over the world. And that kindness is a great resource which needs to be developed, which needs to be mined, if you like. Just like ore inside the ground, it's left there, it will just stay there. But this is a resource inside a human being which, if encouraged, can grow and grow and become an enormous inspiration, a wonderful quality of the human mind and the human heart. And what he was saying here is that being an alms mendicant and going over there, saying, I'm going to starve if you don't feed me, you're encouraging that to grow in a human being. And it's wonderful when it starts to grow, when it starts to be encouraged. This is one of the meditations. The Buddha taught 40 meditations. He taught many more than that, but this was like basic Buddhism. If you look inside the suttas or in the books, you see that the Buddha taught 40 meditations. One of those meditations is meditation on the breath, the one we do here. There's many other meditations, but one of those meditations is a meditation on generosity, on liberality, jhaka anusati. And it's one of those meditations which is, if you like, tucked away in the corner of those 40s, and it's not given much importance. Everyone likes to do a meditation on the feelings, you know, with the, especially the Burmese methods, or meditation on the breath, meditation on metta, loving kindness. But what does it mean, meditation on liberality? It means you recollect the beauty, the joy of sharing, of giving and receiving. I remember, must be 23 years ago, as a young student going to listen to some talks on Buddhism, I was so inspired by one lady. She was a Tibetan nun who was giving a talk not on highfalutin Dhamma. All she was talking about was her work in an orphanage in Sikkim, I think it was, over in the foothills of the Himalayas. And I was so inspired that next Monday I went to my bank, drew out £10. In those days I'd budgeted myself to live on £5 a week. And I still managed to get a little bit over for my holidays. And, you know, it's didn't have very much money. That was like 2 weeks' living expenses for me. And I budgeted that, and I took £10 out and sent it to this orphanage. And for years, even up to now, 20 years, when I recall that, it's only a small amount of money compared to some of the other donations they may have got. When I recall that, it gives me so much happiness. This is what we mean by the meditation on liberality. If you start to recall any act of kindness, of generosity, which you've done in the past, think about it and allow it to, that thought to settle in your heart region. Think what a wonderful thing that is you've done. And think of the effect those orphans in what was then a poor third world country, probably still is a third world country, they may have grown up now, they may have, because of me, they had some food in their belly that day. And that gives so much joy inside of the heart. That joy is needed by human beings today. And as a monastic, when I say that, it's saying that I need you, it's also recognizing that you need me, that we do need one another, that we're not isolated, individual little castles with a moat around, saying I can stack up all of what I need inside and I don't need anyone else ever again in the world. What generosity is saying, what sharing is saying, is we do need one another. I remember years ago seeing this cartoon of two dogs tied together with a leash or with a rope, which was, say, 5 feet long. Say those two dogs were Rover and Spot. Those two dogs each had their own bowl of food, one marked Rover and one marked Spot. And those two bowls of food were 6 feet apart. Okay, so the rope tying them together was 5 feet apart. And Rover was trying to get to Rover's bowl and Spot was trying to get to Spot's bowl. But because of the leash, only 5 feet long, they couldn't both get to the bowl. Rova was pulling Spot to try and get to Rova's bowl. Spot was trying to pull Spot to get to Spot's bowl. And of course, both of them were getting hungry and getting very sore necks. And in this cartoon, in the next frame, they had the little bubbles coming out of both of these little dogs' heads with little light bulbs. They had an idea, they had an insight. And of course, you know what that insight would be. That Spot and Rova decided to cooperate. And they both went over together to Rova's bowl. And Spot and Rova shared that food. In the next frame of the cartoon, the two dogs went over to the other bowl, and they both ate that food. And the last frame of the cartoon, which is the one I like the best, was Rover and Spot snoring away quite happily, cuddled up together. Rover needed Spot to eat his food, and Spot needed Rover to eat his food. Otherwise, they would both go hungry. When we understand that we both need one another, that we can't really live by ourselves in isolated islands, then we start to know what generosity, what sharing really means. And then we can start to develop that part of our heart which is generous. And I don't mean just with material things, but with our time, with our effort. Because we do need to help one another. We do both need to give and also to receive. Not just going out helping other people, but also being open to being helped, open to being served. Even if you can do it better yourself, sometimes it's really good to pretend you can't and allow that person to help you. It's the case of, if ever, I don't know if the Boy Scouts do it these days, if ever a Boy Scout comes along and wants to help you across the road, you should always go, whether you want you to go or not, because that Boy Scout needs to help, needs to do something good. Imagine what that Boy Scout would feel afterwards. I managed to do something good today. I managed to help someone. Doesn't matter if you want to go across or not. Go across the road, and wait till the Boy Scouts out of the way, and out of sight, and then cross back over again. Some time ago, someone, I don't know if they're here this evening, they offered me a pair of socks to keep my little tootsies warm. I've only got one pair of socks, and I've had them ever since I first came here. In fact, even then they were second hand. They actually belonged to the monk who was here before I came, Venerable Poiso. And I still wear them, they're still good. I took them to England last year. And they're quite happy with them. They're very good socks. But this lady gave me some other socks. And they were nowhere near as good. They were short and they were nylon. These ones were really nice wool ones. I saw her come to the monastery to bring some dana, to bring some food for us. As I was walking out of my hut is not that far from the dining hall, I saw that she'd came, I turned round and went back to my hut and put my socks on, the ones that she gave me, just for her. And when I sat down in my place in the dining hall, so you see how I usually sit, for those of you the front anyway, my feet are usually covered by my robe. That day, I uncovered one of my feet and I pointed them out on purpose. And sure enough, that I could see, I was very good at it, not letting her and know that what I was really doing. And out of the corner of my eye, listening very carefully, I saw her turn around to her friend and say, "He's wearing my socks." That made her so happy that I was wearing her socks. And it also made me happy, knowing that I brought a little joy in her life, that her gift, even though quite frankly I didn't really want them, I was wearing them. It was appreciated. Any act of generosity which someone gives to you, value it. It's a wonderful thing in this world, generosity. It needs to be encouraged. Don't throw it away. Don't reject it. Even if you don't want it, accept it. You can always give it to somebody else afterwards. There's a wonderful way that we can keep on channeling an act of generosity from one person to another person. Any excess food which comes to our monastery, we've got a couple of places where we take it. Either a women's refuge, or there's a local referral centre in Armidale where people who are actually quite poor, who for one reason or another fall outside the social safety net and just haven't got anything to eat. Sometimes the people who work there told us that sometimes that people with children, like single mothers especially, that all of the funds they have, they just spend on their children, they don't eat themselves. So we put some of the excess food at that place where people can come and just take it. It's all used. So it doesn't really matter if we're going to eat it at the monastery, we accept it, and if it's not used there, we pass it on. This is developing something inside of us called a heart. The mind might say, oh, that's really being stupid, that's not really the right thing. But if one is developing the heart, so one has to pull the awareness, the attention down to here, to feel what it's like when you're generous, to reflect upon that, make that this meditation on, I'll pass that to generosity. It brings happiness to the heart, it makes us human beings. It realizes the truth that we do need one another. And we do need to share, we do need to cooperate. It stops us being selfish. Selfish is living in a castle, living on an island. Just collecting everything for myself, all that I want and need and think I should have. And forgetting about everyone else in the world, closing all the windows of your castle. Okay, you may think rationally that that might be a wonderful thing to do. Apparently that there's, well, a couple of weeks ago anyway, there was some cult in Texas who had a castle, who was trying to keep everyone else out. You can see where that leads to. So we open up to one another, and the act of generosity is a way of cutting away at that greed, the feeling of mine, this is mine, this belongs to me, I've worked for this, you can't have it, you work yourself, you monks, you go and get a job instead of bludgeoning anyone else. That is like that selfish, that greed, that hardness of the heart. Why should I give? I've worked for this. I've slaved for this. This is my time. What's the result of that? That person becomes like a person, I used to say, with a concrete heart, or with a heart sort of in a concrete box. They may feel very safe in there, but it's an awful place to live. Very, very lonely, being self-sufficient. So developing the heart is going against that. We develop generosity. With that generosity, that sort of sharing with one another, when we realize that we do need one another, that we are sharing lives with one another, it starts to automatically, as a common result, to develop this feeling of kindness, of caring for one another, this feeling of loving kindness, of sharing. The generosity leads to this loving kindness, this compassion, because it's the first act of compassion, isn't it, of giving to someone else who's in need. And not just giving with funds, I mean like giving just an arm around the shoulder, giving a time when you're really busy, you've got so many things to do, but you see that someone really needs just someone to listen to. A lot of the time as a monk, that's a lot of the time what you do. Even the other day that someone rang up in the evening and I was just listening for half. In the end I ended up the telephone conversation by doing some chanting for her over the phone. Dial a blessing. I shouldn't have said that because now that other people are going to do that. And I felt that was appropriate. If that may sound silly, and you know, all of those old words, I mean, and even if you hear them sort of when you're actually present, they don't really, do they have any really magical effect? Was it all superstition? That really didn't really matter. It felt right at the right time. That lady needed just something like that. It worked. And it works if it comes from this place of sharing and caring for one another. When I say like sharing and caring, this is one we develop. We can't just wish it, or we can't think that's a good idea, let's do it. It's practice. Practice makes perfect. Every act of generosity which you can do, jump at the chance. They don't come readily. Every act of generosity you can receive, jump at the chance. You're encouraging and giving someone else an opportunity to develop. Every act of kindness and care which you can give, do it straight away. Don't wait till tomorrow, the chance might be gone. Every act of kindness, compassion you can receive, receive it because you're encouraging and giving someone else a chance to develop. We share compassion just as we share generosity. And what does that do to us? That gives us this wonderful feeling in the heart of contributing to our little community, whether it's just our family or our office or our monastery or wherever. We're actually doing something positive. And the thing is that when we do generosity, when we do loving kindness, compassion, it brings up this wonderful, joyful feeling in the heart. It's one of the great pleasures available to human beings, is to have compassion. Not to receive compassion, that's another joy, is to give compassion. In traditional Buddhism, the Buddha started to say, I said it many times, that compassion is, when one gives compassion towards other beings, it takes you to the sort of feeling, the sort of experience which is typical of a certain heaven realm in Buddhism. A very, very high heaven realm. When you have an act of selfless love, you are feeling the very same feeling which a certain type of devas or these heavenly beings feels all the time. And these heavenly beings are the beings in the Brahma realms. You're having a godlike feeling, the godlike pleasures. That's what you're partaking of when you have a selfless, compassionate moment of caring for someone else. And that's why that when we see acts of real selfless compassion and kindness, that it resonates within us, it brings up something inside of our heart which is so wonderful to experience and to feel. I remember one monk saying that he was looking out, I think it was at a tomato again, he was looking outside of the window in a house in London one morning, and he saw one of these derelicts, the winos, you know, the people who've got no place to sleep, who drink methylated spirits because they can't afford other alcohol, because it keeps them warm at night, because it passes the time in the stupor. I don't know if any of you have ever seen any of those people. I don't know if any of you have seen these people, but I remember seeing them, just the stench of them. You just really want to go away, let alone being bothered by looking at. He saw one morning, I just remember looking outside the window, one of the typical London city businessmen walking down on the pavement with the umbrella, the bowler hat, the pinstripe suit and the briefcase, the whole works. It's a typical businessman going on his way to work. Stop at that door where that derelict was just sleeping and pick him up and take him away to give him a meal. And that sort of acts, which messing up his business suit, making him late for work, going to all that problem, that fellow cared when it was difficult to care. And that just made us think that, told me that that really moved his heart. That just, that gave him so much joy, that resonated inside of him. That was an act of compassion where he never expected to see one. And there are many occasions like that which we've seen in our life, and when we remember them, it brings like happiness, it brings the sun out into this world. It brings joy. This is what the world could be like, can be like. And it's something which is in our power to do ourselves. We can develop that. This is developing the heart part of our... Of course, if we're rational, we think, it's not my job to do that. I'm going to be late for work. I'm going to dirty my suit. I'm going to get in trouble with my boss and my wife, having to clean the suit afterwards, or I might lose my job. If we think like that, if we think rationally, when will we ever do a compassionate act? We'll only do the easy ones, not the ones which really count. That liberality, that generosity, that giving, that selflessness, it's all coming from the same place, comes out as compassion. It comes out as virtue. When we have that heart of compassion, sharing, giving, when we develop the heart, how on earth can we hurt or abuse another being? In fact, when one develops loving kindness, compassion, and generosity, one can't even say harsh words to other people. One can't even get angry at somebody else. How can you get angry at someone else when one realizes we need to live together? We're not self-sufficient islands. I need you. If I get angry at you, that's throwing you away. That's really saying that, you know, I don't need you. Go away. Go somewhere else. Get lost. That's what anger is doing, isn't it? Generosity is saying, I do need you. I do need, if we can work together instead of work separately, look what we can achieve. One of the major reasons why we've got such a strong Buddhist center here is because everyone's working together. Just look around, just all the different colored faces we've got here. All the different ages, the different sexes here. People are working together, no matter what Buddhist tradition they come from. That's where the strength of this Buddhist society is coming from. When we work together, we have that strength. When we work against one another, we're just wasting time. So, this develops the heart part of Buddhism. And that brings enormous joy and happiness inside of us. And outside of us, there's nothing we can't achieve, it seems. Just go from strength to strength. So developing the heart brings great joy and prosperity to us. But especially it brings joy inside of our heart. It brings a softness inside of our heart. It brings that sort of softness which can accept other people, which can overcome anger and irritation. One of these awful banes of our life. Always saying the wrong thing, getting angry at this person, getting irritated because things don't work out. Where does all that come from? Why do I get angry? Because one hasn't developed compassion. One is still self-centered. One has still got something to protect inside of us. One hasn't got that liberality, that giving away. If one is giving away, it's as if one is, it's not living in a castle anymore. One's got open house. Anyone can come in. It's figuratively, this is figuratively speaking. That sort of liberality, that generosity, that kindness, that compassion, which can accept and embrace whoever. And that's why that when I talk about compassion, I like just to mention what my father told me when I was young. As a teenager, he took me aside and said, "The door of my house will always be open to you, no matter what you do." And I keep mentioning that when I'm on the subject of loving kindness, because I haven't found an expression to beat that in his eloquence. The door of his house also meant the door of his heart. He was open. No matter what I did, I became a terrible son to him, someone he was very embarrassed to call his son. That did not matter. He would never close the door of his house. He would never close the door of his heart. His love was unconditional. He was so wide, so generous with his love, that he could give it to me no matter what I was, no matter what I did. If I abused him, if I hit him, if I did terrible things to other people, he was saying that no matter what you do, I'd always love you. That's what we mean by this unbounded. It's such generous, giving love, which is completely irrational. You can't think that. You can only feel it. It comes from developing the heart. When it comes to such sublime heights, it really just takes you way up into the highest heaven realms. To be able to say that to another person, it takes a bit of courage, doesn't it? It takes a bit of inspiration. It takes a bit of trust in the Buddha's teachings. To say to someone else that I'm going to trust you enough that no matter what you do, how you react, what you say to me, I'm never going to close my door of my heart to you. That's what we really mean by compassion. Unbounded. Not in compassion in the castle, but compassion which spreads everywhere throughout the whole universe, all beings. That lifts the heart up and out and all over the place. It spreads you all over. So there's not just a little me inside here, self-sufficient, so we think, just isolated. I'm all right, forget the rest of the world. Your love extends without any bounds. That raises the heart up. When the heart raises up in such joy, the Buddha said, it's very easy to concentrate the mind and become still. Why is it easy to become still? Just basic logic. If you're having a good time, you don't want to go anywhere. The metta, the loving kindness, is one of those other, the 40 meditations. It takes you into the absorptions, the jhanas. These amazing states of mind. These supernormal states of mind. Where one goes into bliss. Why does one go into bliss? Because imagine that feeling, that sensation of unbounded loving kindness complete, no strings attached, it's flowing everywhere. It's like spreading you over the whole universe and not being contained anymore. That you're part of the whole. The whole is you. That feeling of no bounds is bliss. And one can attain to those blissful states of mind in this way. It elevates us. It brings enormous happiness. The sort of happiness which beats sex, which beats drugs cold. None of that can compare to the bliss which can come up in the mind, the joys of such acts of generosity, of kindness, of virtue. So just for the sheer pleasure of it, it's worth doing. And the Buddha was not averse to encouraging people to enjoy those wholesome pleasures, those pleasures which lead to even greater pleasures, which lead to what the Buddha called like renunciation. This generosity, when it gets to its limit, tends towards this renunciation of self, of me and mine. So there's no more me and mine left. The idea of self goes, disappears, fades away. You know that even like the way of loving kindness is a way towards full enlightenment. It's one of those vehicles which a person uses to develop that loving kindness to such a degree that the sense of self completely disappears. And so, from developing the heart, I'm not really considering too much upon the rationality of Buddhism, of working everything out, and how one thing causes another thing, and figuring all of the teachings of the Buddha out. Just developing loving kindness, developing generosity, is the bona fide path to liberation. It liberates us, and it's a very joyful, happy path. For us, for me, I want to get enlightened, this is a wonderful way of doing it. Not only that, but it's also, it serves other beings. It creates that encouragement for other people too to develop their heart, to feel as well as to think. Thinking, rationality is useful. It has its place, but sometimes it's given too much value. I remember a few times the Buddha said that, these wonderful little sayings which I always recall. So whatever you think it's going to be, it will always be something else. When he said that, I thought, well, what's the point of thinking about it then? Answer, there's no point in thinking about it. So, stop. So you stop. If you really contemplate that, it just starts to end the thinking. It takes away the importance we give to thinking. Why do we think so much? Because we have the idea it's useful to do so. If we think about something, we think we can get some solution to it. We can work it out. We can plan it out. And so we can become happy. And get everything which... If we plan it out enough, we really sit down and think about it, take out a pen and paper, and plan it all out, then it's going to go right for a change. Does it ever go right for a change? Usually, there's always something comes along which we don't expect. Whatever we think it's going to be, it will always be something else. So we do plan a little bit, but we plan knowing that it's not going to work out exactly as we hope it's going to be, we think it's going to be, we want it to be. We use our thought, but we don't allow it to use us. We develop the heart, and we keep this thing in balance, the heart and the mind. The thinking and the emotions, we develop both of these things. We develop the faith part, the generous part, the loving kindness, compassionate part of Buddhism, as well as the intellectual part as well. Both have their place, and when they're in balance, we become a very, very strong human being, a very strong Buddhist. I know that the monks in Thailand, Ajahn Chah, when a monk has both wisdom and compassion, then they become wonderful teachers. A monk has compassion but no wisdom. They're wonderful to be around, but what they say doesn't usually make much sense. The monk has a lot of wisdom, but no compassion. What they say is just so dry, and it doesn't really reach people. It doesn't sort of inspire people. But when you have both that compassion and that wisdom working together, it's an enormously powerful force. So the talk I was giving this evening is, encouraging and talking about the development of the heart by developing such things as generosity, seeing its value, looking at it as an act of sharing, encouraging it in oneself to give, and encouraging it in others so that one will receive and acknowledge and not reject any act of kindness or generosity. And encouraging kindness and caring, and encouraging that kindness and caring which becomes virtue. I care enough about other people to restrain what I want to do. I like to do these things, it works right for me, but it's going to hurt someone else. Therefore it's unvirtuous. Virtue in Buddhism is doing that which won't hurt another being and won't hurt yourself. As simple as that. It's just a basic compassion towards other beings and towards oneself. That's what virtue is. And one develops this wonderful compassion, loving kindness, which is a bona fide meditation, which takes you into absorptions, which takes you to liberation. So may you all be liberated, may you all develop your heart for the benefit of yourselves and all other beings. Thank you very much for this evening, listening to this evening's talk. Has anyone got any questions or comments before we have some announcements? Has anyone got any questions or comments they'd like to ask before we wind up? Okay, if you do have any questions or comments, please come up and ask them. Sometimes people, I've been told that they are a bit over-generous to other people. So let other people have a chance to come up and speak to the monks. And they never come up themselves. So at least like sometime come up and say hello to the monks. And if there's anything you'd like to say or to comment on, it's nice to see you all. Because usually sometimes we just see the same old people every week. They're nice to see also. I almost blew it there.